Blog Talk Radio. This Monday, April 30th, 2018.
Breaking news number one. The FAA registry has assigned Boeing 767-233 registration number N770JM of Eastern Airlines LLC in Greensboro, North Carolina by Dorothy Gagnon. A Facebook post indicating the assigned number for the Eastern Airlines LLC aircraft, formerly Dynamic Air, was assigned. A hyperlink to the FAA website registry for numbers assigned on the form, according to this registration, indicates the number N767-233 submitted by Eastern Airlines LLC is assigned. The last article on the Internet for Aviation News Online indicates that this particular aircraft, the N767-233, will be slated to have the paint color of Eastern and is scheduled once the FAA registered the numbers. So another update, we found Spotter's photo shows the Boeing 767-233 registration N770JM is being painted with the Eastern name on it, and we'll patiently wait to see the end results of the painting. See more on newsletter Eastern Airlines Dynamic.
Breaking news number two. High-tech solutions help airlines lose fewer bags. This is by Airwise News. Airlines are misplacing fewer passenger bags, as reported by SITA. SITA, S-I-T-A, is the world's leading specialist in air transport communication and information technology. SITA's report for this year, 2018, shows that last year, 2017, the number of people flying had grown to over 4 billion passengers, with 4.6 billion bags carried each year. Bags which were mishandled numbered only a little under 6, 5.57 to be exact, per 1,000 passengers. That was the lowest rate of mishandled bags ever reported. The mishandled bags did cost the industry $2.3 billion last year. Percentage-wise, passengers numbers have risen by 64% since 2007. But at the same time, the rate of bags which were mishandled dropped by 70.5%. You can see more on newsletters January to June 2018.
Breaking news number three. American Airlines tops the world's most valuable airline list in 2018. This was by Enrique Perella and James Field. London. Brand Finance, a valued and strategy consulting company, has released its 50 most valuable airline brands of the world report, coming up with some startling results. American Airlines, for the second consecutive year, has come on top with a list of a whopping $9.1 million in brand value. Delta Airlines came in second with $8.7 billion. followed by United Airlines. But even though the top three U.S. carriers are leading the list, not all is good news for the U.S. airline industry. American Airlines retains its number one position, but has a 7% decrease in value in at least 12 months. Likewise, Delta also shows 6% decrease, whereas United only dropped a few points. You can see more of this in the newsletter Jan to June 2018. Over to you, Chuck.
American Airlines flight makes emergency landing at RDU through ABC at their station WTVD. American Airlines flight made an emergency landing at RDU Thursday morning. Flight 3356 from Dallas to RDU landed at the airport just before 1 a.m. Officials with the airline said an indicator light went off during the flight. The spokesperson also said flight attendants on board smelled an odor, which caused the 10 passengers and three crew members to evacuate through the main door on the runway. No emergency slide was used. Passengers were then taken to their terminal by bus. ABC 11 News spoke with several passengers who said they never saw any sign of smoke. However, they claimed that they were told when they landed because of a sensor malfunction. No injuries had been reported. Maintenance is evaluating the plane. See more on newsletter Jan-June 2018. Hello, Eastern family. Great having you with us. My name is Chuck Albright, coming to you from a place in Florida called The Villages. I'm sitting in for Jim Hart tonight. He's under the weather. I'm sure he's having a good time at Martha's Vineyard up in Maine, along with our other hosts at different locations. We want to welcome and thank you for listening and calling into the show. You have truly made the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We love to hear your comments and share your memories with the radio listeners from around the world. If you haven't called a show before, all you have to do is call into 213-816-1611 and just say, hi, aloha, buenos dias, como esta, bonjour, to talk to us on the air live. We'll see if we can find an interpreter if you need one. We can identify many countries around the world who listen in with our Blog Talk Radio application. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eastern legacy going out to not only the Eastern family, but to listeners from all many different types of countries? That's what we try to do every week on the EAL radio show. Won't you join us by adding your voice to these broadcasts? Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.EALradioshow.com, or perhaps by signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Should you wish to talk during our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, 213-816-1611, at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Let me repeat the number so you can write it down on your Monday night visits. 213-816-1611. Don't forget to press the number one button when you want to talk. And tell your friends about us. Our lines are always open. And if you choose not to participate and talk live with our hosts, we ask you to please mute your phone, because our producer does not have the capability of filtering out background noises, like ice in little glasses. Now, Mr. Producer, let's get Flight Episode 363 in the air.
Let's take eastern scrape silver green. You make the clouds a byway when you take heaven's highway. In a moment, your fondest dreams complete. To fly from frost to flowers in just 8 hours when you travel.
Good evening, folks. The captain of Eastern Flight 587 was Captain Clarence Shipe Childs, age 31, and a native of Tennessee. Captain Childs has logged over 8,500 hours of flight time and is a veteran of World War II. His military rank was Lieutenant Colonel and was named Commander of the Air Transport Command Ascension Island Base. After the war, he went to work for Eastern as a full-time commercial pilot. He was still serving as Lieutenant Colonel in the Air Force while working with Eastern. First Officer John B. Whitted, age 30, was a native of North Carolina, veteran of World War II, and flew B-29s in the war. John goes by the nickname of J.B. The date is July 24th, 1948, and checking in at the Houston Hobby Airport, the conversation went something like this.
Now, you know, JB, I sure don't like the backside of the box flight, but it does give us a great layover in Houston. How about you? You got some rest? Ready for all these stops to Atlanta?
Yeah, I'm fine, Skipper. I got lots of rest. I'll help you all I can, including trying to stay awake. If it wasn't for the stops along the way, this would be a boring flight, especially getting into Atlanta. The weather sure looks good, though, and I'm spotting out there in the black sky tonight. Maybe we can spot an occasional shooting star. I've seen several on this flight in the past.
Yeah, it should be a smooth flight, and I see we only have 22 passengers on board, so barging. Ought to be able to work this flight without any problems. I filed VFR at 5,500 feet, and we got a little tailwind, so we should clip along about 150 knots.
Sounds good, Skipper. I'll go on out and kick the tires and check to make sure we have the right fuel that you ordered. I'll see you back on board.
Flight 576 departed Houston at 8:40 p.m. and made stops in Beaumont, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Mobile, Montgomery, prior to reaching their destination in Atlanta. At 2:45 a.m., in clear, dark skies between Mobile and Montgomery, Alabama, en route to Atlanta, Captain Childs motions to First Officer Whitted.
Wow! J.B., did you see that? It's coming straight toward us. What in the world? What do you think it is? You know, it might be some military airplane.
Yeah, wow. It looks orangish, and it's coming fast. Looks like we're right on a collision course.
When it appeared the object was going to collide with the airplane, Captain Childs banked the airplane to the left to avoid a mid-air collision. Strangely enough, the object in turn banked to its left as if to avoid collision itself. Whitted looked outside his window and saw the object streaking silently by about half a mile from the wingtip on his side of the airplane and 500 feet higher.
Man, that was close. Did you see what it looked like? It was like a rocket ship straight out of Buck Rogers.
Yeah. Did you see that blue glow all around? It looked to me like it was about 100 feet long, and it was all in behind it. I bet it was close to the speed of sound, 500 at least.
I'm still not seeing clearly. That light nearly blinded me as it shot by. And you notice that orangish, reddish plume as it passed? That must have been the exhaust.
Yeah, well, listen. call Margie up here and let's see if it's one of the captains saw that thing.
A chime is sounded for the stewardess to come up to the cockpit.
Yes, sir, Captain. Hey, what just happened a few minutes ago? I felt this entire aircraft being thrown around.
Yeah, Margie, the captain had to take an immediate maneuver to avoid a collision that we still can't figure out. Did anyone in the captain ask what the light outside the aircraft was?
Most of the passengers were asleep, but there was one guy, and he told me he saw something. He said his name is Clarence McKelvey. He's an editor from Columbus, Ohio. And he said he saw a strange, eerie, cherry red streak of fire, but no other details. What's going on?
After the plane safely landed in Atlanta, the two pilots were given reports of the incidents to reporters, Eastern Airline officials and the military officials. Project Sign was again called to investigate. The pilots made sketches of the craft for the Sign personnel. Now, the days around the early morning hours of July 24, 1948 were full of reports of a UFO from both ground and air in the region. Obviously, something was in the skies in the days around the incident, and that night in particular. Reports came in of a mysterious sighting at Robins Air Force Base in Georgia. Sighting July 23rd in Chamblee, Georgia. A sighting July 26th in Blackstone, Virginia. And Greensboro, North Carolina sightings on July 24th. According to reports, the early morning of July 24th was full of strange flying objects. At 2:30 a.m., another crew of Eastern Airlines, Flight 571, on the 23rd, a Douglas DC-3, again, flying near Blackstone, Virginia, not far from Richmond, noticed a brilliant, slow, meteor-like traveling on a dead horizontal path. It lasted for 3 seconds and seemed to be moving on a southwesterly heading. Its unusual horizontal trajectory riveted their attention. Eastern Flight 573, not far away, noticed it too.
As related to actual sightings of UFOs in the early commercial days of aviation, the three classic UFO cases of the late 40s by the Blue Book head, Captain Edward J. Riplett. Remember, Roswell at that time had not been broken open, and everyone accepted the Air Force explanation. Eastern Flight of Captain Childs and co-pilot Whittet, we just reenacted ranks right up there with the JAL 1628 case as far as commercial airliner UFO encounters are concerned. Out of these cases covered very recently, this one has at least an acceptable alternative explanation. This case also is likely the most interesting. In regard to it, it shows a clear attempt by the Air Force personnel to really find out what's going on. There are even divided sides of what it was between an extraterrestrial ET guy craft and a Russian secret craft. The conclusion reached by the Air Force personnel in this case led many to believe that this and others were truly extraterrestrial in nature. These early cases should open some eyes out there to the fact that regardless of what you think the cause, something is going on in our skies, and it has been for many decades or even more. Dorothy, can you tell us about the Japan Airline 1629?
Chuck, on November 17, 1986, the Japanese crew of a JAL Boeing 747 cargo freighter witnessed three unidentified objects after sunset while flying over eastern Alaska. The objects seemed to prefer the cover of darkness to their left and to avoid the brighter skies to their right. At least the first two of the objects were observed by all three crew members, Captain Kenyu Terauchi, Japanese, an ex-fighter pilot with more than 10,000 hours flight experience in the cockpit's left-handed seat, co-pilot Takanori Tamafuji in the right-hand seat, and flight engineer Yoshio Tsukoba. The routine cargo flight entered Alaska on autopilot, cruising at 565 miles per hour at an altitude of 35,000 feet. At 1709, the Anchorage ATC advised a new heading towards Talkeetna, Alaska. As soon as the JAL-1628 straightened out of its turn at 1711, Captain Taruchi noticed two craft to his far left and some 2,000 feet below his altitude, which he assumed to be military aircraft. Those were pacing his flight path and speed. At 1718 or 1719, the two objects abruptly veered to a position about 500 feet or 1,000 feet in front of the aircraft, assuming a stacked configuration. In doing so, they activated a kind of reverse thrust, and their lights became dazzling bright. To match the speed of the aircraft from their sideways approach, the objects displayed were Taruchi described as a disregard for inertia. The thing was flying as if there was no such thing as gravity. It sped up, then stopped, then flew at our speed in our direction, so that to us it appeared to be standing still. The next instant, it changed course. In other words, the flying object had overcome gravity. The reverse thrust caused a bright flare for 3 to 7 seconds, to the extent that Captain Taruchi could feel the warmth of their glows. Don, was air traffic control aware of this?
Yes, air traffic control was notified at this point at 1719, who could not confirm any traffic in the indicated position. After 3 to 5 minutes, the objects assumed a side-to-side configuration, which they maintained for another 10 minutes. They accompanied the aircraft with an undaulting motion and some back-and-forth motion of their jet nozzles, which seemed to be under automatic control, causing them to flare with brighter or duller illumination. Each object had a square shape consisting of two rectangular arrays of what appeared to be glowing nozzles or thrusters, separated by a dark central section. Captain Teriyachi suspected in his drawings that the objects would appear centrifugal if viewed from another angle, and that the observed movement of the nozzles could be ascribed to the cylinder's rotation. The objects left abruptly at 1723, moving to a point below the horizon to the east. Where the first objects disappeared, Captain Teriyachi now noticed a pale band of light that mirrored their altitude, speed, and direction. Setting their onboard radar scope to 25 nautical mile range, he confirmed an object in the expected 10 o'clock direction at about 7.5 nautical mile distance and informed ATC of its presence. Anchorage found nothing on their radar, but Elmendorf's NORAD Regional Operations Control Center, directly in the flight path, reported a surge primarily return after some minutes. As the city lights of Fairbanks became to illuminate the object, Captain Teriyachi believed to perceive the outline of a gigantic spaceship on his port side that was, quote, twice the size of an aircraft carrier. It was, however, outside First Officer Damarucci's field of view. Teriyachi immediately requested a change of course to avoid it. The object, however, followed him, in the same relative position throughout the 45-degree turn, a descent from 35,000 to 31,000 feet, and a 360-degree turn. Short-range radar of Fairbanks Airport however, failed to register the object. Anchorage ATC offered military intervention, which was declined by the pilot. The object was not noted by any of the two pilots which approached Japanese Airlines 1628 to confirm its presence. By all time, JAL 1628 had also lost sight of the of it. Japan Airlines 1628 arrived safely in Anchorage at 1820.
Yeah, Don, Captain Taruchi cited in the official FAA report that the object was a UFO. In December of 1986, Taruchi gave an interview to two Kyoto News journalists. JAL soon grounded him for talking to the press and moved him to a desk job. He was only reinstated as a pilot many years afterwards and eventually retired in North Kanto, Japan. Then on 29 January of 1987, at 1840 time, Alaska Airlines Flight 53 observed a fast-moving object on their onboard weather radar. While at 35,000 feet, some 60 miles west of McGrath, on a flight from Nome to Anchorage, their radar registered a strong target in their 12 o'clock position at 25 miles range. While they couldn't distinguish any object or light visually, they noticed that the radar object was increasing its distance at a very high rate. With every sweep of their radar, about 1 second apart, the object added 5 miles to its distance, translating into a speed of approximately 18,000 miles per hour. The pilot, however, relayed a speed of a mile a second to the control tower, or a speed of 3,600 miles per hour, but confirmed that the target exceeded both the 50 and 100-mile ranges on his radar in a matter of seconds. That object was outside the radar range of the Anchorage ARTCC, and additional radar data covering the specified time and location failed to substantiate the pilot's claim. Now, let's take a look at some recent sightings. Linda, do you have some reports for recent sightings?
George, I really do. From Washington, CNN News reported a military video of an unidentified aircraft that has been made public, and this is following the Pentagon saying that they had shelved any initiative devoted to identifying unknown objects in aerospace. There's an organization called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, and it is co-founded by the musician Tom DeLonge. He's the musician who founded the American pop band. They released a video titled Go Fast. What it is Defense Department's footage from an F-A-18 Super Hornets video of the high-speed flight of an unidentified aircraft. The Pentagon declined to comment about the footage to CNN and to the STARS Academy, and they said multiple government organizations reviewed the video for release and that anybody can obtain this video because they can use the Freedom of Information Act request. The publication of military footage follows the same revelations given last year from the New York Times and Politico about the past Pentagon effort on unidentified aerial phenomena and the publication of two videos showing Navy pilots encountering with unidentified objects. Luz Elizondo, the former head of the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, he now works at this To the Stars Academy. He told CNN that the newly released video provides further evidence of what he said is likely a much larger cache of Pentagon materials about unidentified aerial phenomena, and he underscored the need for public conversation around this issue. He said these are just three videos that have come out that everybody's looking at right now, but there's far more compelling evidence that I was privy to. You know, I think you're looking at the tip of the iceberg.
Linda, Elizondo went on to say that the organization obtained the video through reporting channels, but declined to get into detail about the group's sources and methods. He said that they followed the proper process to get the videos and that the Department of Defense approved their release. In an acknowledgement of the program last year, the Pentagon said the initiative ended in 2012, and former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid told the Times its funding came from black money, as Reid likes to talk like that, meaning appropriations for covert programs. It was determined that there were other higher priority issues that merited funding, and it was in the best interest of the Department of Defense to make a change, Pentagon spokesman Tom Crossan told CNN at the time. CNN safety analyst Don Soucy, who has worked in civilian aviation agencies, said he was taken aback in particular by the lack of heat indicated in the video by the object and bemoaned the project's reported ending. He quoted, to quote him, he said, "This is literally no explanation for this in my mind," Soucy said. On Monday, Elizondo also noted eerie similarities between the new video and the ones released last year, including the location of the in U.S. airspace, the presence of U.S. Navy pilots, the tic-tac shape of the object, and other signatures he said the video shared in common. Elizondo said he did not believe the object was necessarily a little green space alien, but that they couldn't rule anything out, and that even if the object is simply a foreign object, that alone should be alarming. He was quoted as saying it could be anything, so I wouldn't rule anything out, and that's why I think we need to look at it, Elizondo said. I mean, it could be Russian, it could be Chinese, it could be little green men from Mars. We don't know what the hell it is. CNN's Ryan Brown contributed to this report. Now, let's hear the rest of the story from of the Childs Wittig sighting. Jim?
Yeah, thank you, George. Back in 1948, Project Sign was created to investigate unidentified flying objects under the auspices of the U.S. Air Force. The first thing Project Sign wanted to do was to impress airline pilots with the idea that they should not reveal such incidents to the press before they reported them to the airport. On July 30th, Alfred Loding, who was Project Sign's civilian engineering analyst, arrived at Eastern's office in New York and personally asked the airline's vice president of flight operations to forward any future flying object sightings directly to a Colonel McCoy at Wright Field. Eastern's president, Eddie Rickenbacker, was suspicious about Loading and wrote directly to McCoy to confirm the instructions. When Rickenbacker was satisfied that Loading was who he said he was, he issued orders to his pilots to do as the Project Sign asked. Now, it's not difficult to understand the dilemma that the Childs Wittig sightings presented to Project Sign. If the description of the object was accurate, a huge rocket resembling a current U.S. concept for a satellite launcher, which had not been revealed to the public, but obviously was familiar to Air Force intelligence personnel, since Cabell had requested RAN assessment of UFO propulsion technology just days before, that had been hurtling over the southeast U.S. It was almost impossible to believe that a secret U.S. vehicle of this type actually existed, and even harder to believe that it was foreign. What other alternatives were there? Had the pilots mistaken some conventional aircraft for a giant missile? This should be ruled out, seemingly, by the prominent flame that the object was emitting. Few jets had afterburners in 1948, and even those that did were not likely to be mistaken for something as large and weird as the objects that the pilots had reported. A meteor seemed to be another possibility, but the fact that the pilots were sure it had maneuvered and climbed ruled this out in the minds of the investigators. The double row of windows described by Childs caught the attention of some of the Sign investigators when they were studying the newspapers immediately after receiving the report, because, by coincidence, stories about the cross-country flight of a new U.S. Navy Lockheed transport plane, the RV-6 Constitution, shared the headlines with stories about the pilot sighting. The huge RV-6 was unusual in that it had two decks and two rows of windows on the sides of its cigar-shaped fuselage. Was it possible that Childs and Wittig at adding near miss with the enormous Navy plane. Good fatigue and surprise have led them to perceive it as a bizarre flame-spewing rocket. Project Sign was determined to leave no stone unturned in attempting to solve this case. So on August the 2nd, Colonel McCoy of Project Sign dutifully sent a teletype to the Navy's Flight Operations Office at Patuxent Navy River Naval Air Station to inquire about the exact position of the RB-6 at the time of sighting. Now, George, tell us, what was the reaction of the military?
Well, thanks, Jim. Obviously, this event shook up the military. I mean, they had to be thinking, how can these objects be flying around in our airspace and we know nothing about them? The Air Force was besieged with questions. Major General Charles Cabell, Director of Air Force Intelligence, personally ordered a Project Sign investigation of the Childs-Witted report. Air Force insiders must have been shocked by the sketches the two pilots produced. They looked exactly like the RAND world-circling spaceship and the Navy HATV studies. General George Kenney, the Chief of Strategic Air Command, said wistfully in Santa Monica, Project RAND's headquarters, that the Air Force didn't have anything like the object, but he wished it did. The Childs-Witted sighting was long considered one of the most significant early UFO reports by both Air Force and civilian researchers, but the existence of the secret space launcher designs, with their strong resemblance to the object, provides an important clue to the urgency and magnitude of the Air Force reaction to the report. So what we have here is probably one of the best cases, if not the single best ever, in UFOlogy. We literally have the military running around trying to find answers and addressing the public. Here is a press memorandum issued to the press on April 27, 1949. Maybe now we can understand why the military feels the need to suppress this information, even if we don't agree that one can understand the anticipation of mass fear concerning that there is technology out there that is far more advanced than ours, even now. Luckily for us, this was still a time before the real cover-up began. So the press release, courtesy of bluebookarchive.org, memorandum to the press, number M26-49, for immediate release on April 27, 1949. Go ahead, Don.
All right, now let's... getting back to the Eastern flight pertaining to the Charles Witten case. Perhaps the fantastic saucer flight sighting in technical intelligence records was the widely publicized, quote, spaceship, which two Eastern Airlines pilots reported encountering in the skies around Montgomery, Alabama, last July. Presumably, the same object was seen by ground observers at Robins Air Force Base, Macon, Georgia, about a half hour before. All reports agreed it was going in a southerly direction, trailing various colored flames, and that it behaved like a normal aircraft insofar as disappearing from a line of sight that was concerned. The EAL pilots, Captain C.S. Charles and John B. Witten, described the phenomena as wingless aircraft, 100 feet long, cigar-like shaped, and twice as the diameter of a B-29 with no protruding surfaces. We saw it at the same time and asked each other, what in the world is this? Charles told investigators what it was. It flashed down towards us and veered to the left. It veered its left and passed us about 700 feet to our right and above us. Then, as the pilot had seen us, it wanted to avoid us. It pulled up with a tremendous burst of flame from the rear and zoomed into the clouds. Its prop wash, or jet wash, rocketed our DC-3. The flame-shooting mysteriously aircraft
described by the EAL pilots, had no fins, but appeared to have a snout similar to a radar pole in front, and it gave the impression of a cabin with windows above. Captain Charles declared the cabin appeared like a pilot compartment, except brighter. He said the illumination inside the body itself approximated the brilliance of a magnesium flare. We saw no occupants, he told investigators. From the side of the craft came an intense flare, dark blue glow, then ran the entire length of the fuselage, like a blue fluorescent factory light. The exhaust was a red-orange flame with a lighter color predominant around the outer edges. Pilots said the flame extended 30 to 50 feet behind the object and became deeper intensely as the aircraft pulled up into the clouds. Its speed was said to be about one-third faster than common jets. In their investigation of the incident, Project Saucer personnel screened 225 citizens, civilian and military flight schedules, and found that only other aircraft in vicinity at the time was an Air Force C-47. Application of the Prandtl theory of lift to the incident indicated that a fuselage of the dimensions reported by Charles and Witten could support a load compatible to the weight of an aircraft of this size at speeds and subsonic range. The object is still under consideration, unidentified.
Here's a summary of the description of the craft and its effects. Craft was cigar-shaped. Craft was around 100 feet long. Craft caused some kind of jet wake affecting the plane. That's according to one witness. Craft made intelligent maneuvers. Craft had a large, about 50 feet in length, plume-colored orange-red exhaust. The underside of the craft had a, quote, blue glow. The craft appeared to be moving in excess of 700 miles per hour. The object had two rows of windows or openings from which an orange glow was emanating. No occupants were seen inside the craft. UFO was in sight for no more than 8 seconds. No visible wings were seen. No sound was heard from the craft. No jet engines, no air ducts or cockpit were seen. The side note is that visibility that morning was over 25 miles and clear. The Pentagon first suggested that the men had seen a weather balloon, but this suggestion was quickly withdrawn within days. An Air Force spokesman admitted the sighting was credible, further stating, quote, this country has no plane resembling a double-deck, jet-propelled, wingless transport shooting a 40-foot flame out of its back end, unquote. Astronomer Dr. J. Allen Hynek, a consultant to SIGN, argued that if the pilots had reported accurately what they had seen, that no astronomical explanation was even remotely plausible. However, he did offer an admittedly far-fetched explanation, suggesting that the pilots had seen an extraordinary meteorite.
Well, that's the end of our scripted show, and we want to open it up for discussion. And I might say that, to begin with, I knew J.B. Whitted very well. I flew many, many trips. As a matter of fact, when I first checked out on the Boeing 727, he was the most understanding captain, although he was not favored by a lot of ground crew people. In that he wanted precise paperwork done. You remember that, Jim Holder. And, yeah, and he turned the paper back and said, fix it, and not telling the ground crew what was wrong, and that was their job to find out what was wrong with the paperwork. I recalled on several trips with John, JB, we all referred to JB. I did have the chance flying the 727. I flew the Convair with him and the 727. And I did have, I just couldn't help but ask him about the incident that he and Captain Childs had experienced in that DC-3 back in 1948. And he was very reluctant to talk about it. He said, yeah, it happened. And that's about all he would say about it. I guess he was ridiculed and I guess almost made a fool of because of citing such a phenomena that we still don't understand today. But JB was a very experienced captain, and I learned a lot from JB Whitted, and a good fortune of flying with him on many, many flights. How about you, JB? Did JB Holder, Jim Holder, did you fly with JB Whitted?
Oh, yeah. I flew with Whitted many times, mostly to L.A. And like you said, he was not really liked by the ground people. But he got along fine with the pilots when I flew with him. I enjoyed flying with him. And my memory is that he brought it up, that what had happened. To me, I hadn't heard about it. And he talked about it, said something about, you know, UFOs and all that. And so I was listening to him, of course, and that was the first time I'd heard about it. And he told me basically what we've seen tonight, what he described it as. But I didn't know he was flying with Sharp Childs. He just meant he was flying with a captain. And I flew with Sharp Childs on training flights out in Greater Southwest when we were training on the 727 out there. But we didn't have time to talk about UFOs during those flights, I guarantee you. But we did, you know, he was very believable, and they saw something in my mind. I think the way he described it to me, they saw something. It wasn't made up at all.
You know, I used to say that there was no such thing as a UFO, and there was always something that could answer what people actually thought they saw. But there are so many incidents now and reported not only by flight crews and those on the ground, of course, and also air traffic control. And I think we had Lewis on, George, Jeff Lewis, I believe that's a friend of yours. He's an ATC controller out on the West Coast, retired. And he, when we had another show talking about UFOs, had explained that he had seen something on his scope, I believe it was. But at any rate, this past week, I think it was, in the last 2 weeks, we've had several reports of UFOs and even showing up on the radar screens of our military jets. So what's your thoughts? Any of our hosts or any of our listeners? Got a bunch of listeners. I'm going to open all the microphones up. So if you want to tell of an incident, maybe you've seen one.
You know, those flights, some of them took place over Alaska. And I'm just curious if the Aurora Borealis at that time might have had something to do with magnifying a flock of birds or something like that. And it's kind of dumb, I guess, but I don't know. There's stuff out there.
Jim Holder and myself and George, we've all flown in the northern latitudes going out to Seattle, and we've all at night seen the beautiful Aurora Borealis and the dancing of the fire dancing. I just can't see that what has been described by these pilots, especially JAL, Japan Airlines, and some of these others, that it could possibly be the Borealis.
No, I wouldn't think so. The ones that I've seen out there, it was very obvious that it, what it was, the Borealis.
Yeah, I agree with
you. It was just a thought.
March 29th, there was an article that two pilots report close encounters with a UFO over Arizona. And they had a talk with the control tower back and forth, and that was Phoenix Air and Learjet. So I haven't got the article up on the website, but after the discussion tonight, I will put it up there in newsletter online. It's a little lengthy, but it really is interesting. So you can take a look at that after we're through with the show. I'll try to get it up there.
Well, I have a comment about the... Go ahead.
Yeah, Hawkins was talking one time, and this guy, the new astrophysicist, Neil, if you have an extraterrestrial that's going to fly not miles per hour, we're talking light years to get to our solar system, and all they do is fly around the Earth and disappear, that doesn't seem very logical that they would fly this distance, because that would take years to do it. Now, why would we just see them and then they disappear and we don't see them again? I mean, you have to understand that extraterrestrials have to come from somewhere outside our solar system. And right now, I believe that last satellite that we sent just passed Jupiter. It's taken 9 years, and it still isn't out of our solar system yet.
Talking about, from Earth to Jupiter, though, is kind of like from Jacksonville to Daytona Beach. Considering the observable universe has got, I just had my researcher here, Emery Martinelli, look up how many universes are observable, and he said over 200 billion observable universes out there.
Well, that I think it was the one that Chuck was just talking about. They turned the camera around and it took periodic views back toward our solar system as it was going out, and our sun there at the very end was a little pinpoint of light. Very pinpoint of light. We are basically nothing in the great scheme of things.
Yeah.
But we know about it, like Neil, like you said, we know about it. And it is it's hard to believe that if we somebody is so interested enough to fly all those billions and billions and billions of miles to come here and buzz our airplanes, it doesn't really make sense. I'll say one other thing about these people talking about seeing these things on their airborne radar. You're lucky sometimes you can see a thunderstorm of those things back in the 40s and 50s. They're a lot better now than they used to be, but you can't pick up an airplane out there. That's why we have transponders, so the guys on the ground can see us. Now, we're going to see another airplane over there somewhere. Now, we've got that thing now they came out with by the time I retired where you could see the little spots when you were flying over an airport. You could see down below all those, what do they call that thing, Neil, George? TCAS or something like that?
Yeah, TCAS.
You could see an airplane that on that, but that really wasn't a radar. That was just a radio, I guess it was a radar of some sort. I really don't put much stock in this whole thing myself.
Well, they have to have a transponder to show up on TCAS also.
So,
I don't know. When you look out there on a clear night and you see all the stars and all the things that we don't know, you say, oh my goodness, there's got to be somebody else out there. And if they're more advanced than we are, maybe they can get around a lot quicker than we can,
I believe that.
And
one of the One of the things they brought up is these extraterrestrials have conquered the idea of going through black holes in space, which just propels you through space at phenomenal speeds. And they have some way of controlling their craft to get through a black hole, because most black holes just suck up everything that's within sight. I mean, they eat up planets.
They eat up planets.
Yeah.
You know, that's one theory.
And, you know, also, as we described tonight in our information that we had, that, I forgot what I was going to say. somebody say something. Let me think about what my thought was.
And just like we were talking about, if they come here to observe us, and then they fly off, what point does that make? What have they accomplished? I mean, some of the people say they were carried off in a spaceship and they were brought back. There was the thing in, what is it, the 50s or 60s, where the cattle and goats and everything, their organs were taken out, and they don't know how it was. It wasn't done with a scalpel and wasn't done with at that particular time, they didn't have what they call laser knives that can do that like they do today. So, I mean, those are things that we already know about the crop things. Those were just hoaxes done by people that actually went and crushed the crops. But, you know, the other things that we thought were extraterrestrial, I was reading about the drawings down in South America that are hundreds and hundreds of feet long. And the only way you can really tell what they are is you have to be in the air. And they haven't figured out how a way that the Nesca, I think they're called Nesca Indians, would do that. And so that's something. And they've seen these drawings in the caves where they got stick figures with helmets on them with little things that look like antennas. And they're saying that the drawings are millions of years old. So that's the other side of the coin. You know,
I remember now what I was going to say, that in our script here, that the unidentified flying objects were as if they didn't even, gravity had no influence over them. It was as if they could do whatever they wanted to. As far as the maneuvering the airplanes or these UFOs or whatever they call them. And so it's very interesting, and I'm sure you think we'll have some more reports of unidentified flying objects here this coming week or in the future. It dates way back. I think back in Leonardo's time, I'm sure. Da Vinci.
You know, the Air Force did build a flying saucer, and it flew. They flew it out of air.
Not very well, though.
No, not very well. But
and
they
then,
did,
of course,
they
got
did
those,
build it, and they did fly it. But it didn't go 700 miles an hour.
No, it didn't go 70. And those two good old boys down in Pascagoula, Mississippi, were fishing under the bridge. Remember that? And through their alcohol-laden brines, they got taken up and examined and put back and all that kind of stuff, too. And that made the national scene. And I think they weren't allowed to drink and go fishing anymore at Pascagoula, Mississippi. They got banned.
The only one I can think is that couple that was they claimed that they were abducted and taken up and probed and probed. And he came back, and the man, sat there and drew a celestial map. And at that particular time, there was no way in the world that we had the capability of drawing that map until later on in the centuries later, I guess you might want to say, they found out that the map was exactly the way the stars and stuff were. And they don't know how he did it. He claims he was told he was showed a map in one of the spaceships, and he just copied it by memory.
Yeah.
So that's one of the unsolved mysteries. This is kind of something I like to delve into. I used to be one of these UFO comic book kids, and I just kept going as I got older. Hawking's was probably my mentor, so to speak, about what's going on in astrophysics. And now this guy, Neil Tyson Nagasi is his name. He's pretty knowledgeable about where Hawking's left off. But he talks to the average person. He explains it. You know, he explains what he knows what he's talking about. He's got a TV show, and he's on the History Channel.
Okay, well, we're going to kind of wrap it up here. And Dorothy?
Hey.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it sounds like you got a UFO breaking in here or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like we're about to get a dust
feeling.
I think so.
I'm going to die.
We've got two area codes.
They're
from the Villages, 863. If you'd like to say something, we'd be happy to hear from you. And some more. So I've got all the microphones open. Well, Dorothy, tell us what we've got coming up and how the website's shaping up and all.
All right. So on the website, we have some interesting letters from the past. Jack Serretta had written us a very nice letter last week when he was on our show, and that was about the tenure at EAL. So that's in there underneath the tab from the past. Also under testimonials and comments is quite a few notes and comments on the Eastern Brat 2 show, which was very encouraging for us to continue to have an Eastern Brat 3. We also have coming up next week, May 7th, it's going to be Flying in the Golden Age, and that'll be another very interesting, fun show about Eastern Airline L-1011 Whisper Liners and all of the times of different aircraft back then. And we have May 14th, the episode will be coming up as Airline Humor, Laughter, and Fun. And, of course, that's going to be hilarious. So we're looking forward to that very much. And don't forget, on Thursday this week, May 3rd, is going to be the new series, Listening In to the Adventures of Sky King. So we're anxious to see what Neil has planned for us with that show. Following that, the following week will be the part two of the Captain John Halliburton. We have to apologize. The technical difficulties last week couldn't avoid not having the show, couldn't do it. So just to let you know that it was technical difficulties, and no matter what Neil did, it just couldn't be done. Radio website is excellent. There's a lot of things on there. We have the notes about the Eastern, the Reaper, the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. They have their upcoming convention. Go to their website or to our website. It'll give you a little more information on it, as well as the Silver Liners coming up on May 17th. And at the Silver Liners, we plan to be there, and that's going to be on Thursday, May 17th at 11 o'clock. It's going to be on the radio broadcast, so be sure to listen in to us then, and we'll announce it as we go along. Back to you, Neil.
Well, yeah, and we intend to interview a lot of flight attendants at the Silver Liners convention there. Hopefully we can get them to talk about some of the pilots who gave them hard times on flights to see who they are. I'm sure we'll have a good time. And if you're in the area, you ought to stop by. What's the dates of that again?
That's May 17th on a Thursday at 11 o'clock.
All right.
Don't forget, Neil.
May 17th.
Okay, May 17th. And tell us about Jim Hart. Jim Hart's in the hospital, Dorothy.
Yes, Jim Hart is in the Martha's Vineyard Hospital. He's been in there for, this is the third day now that he's been in there. His neighbor brought him in, and he had swollen legs, so they're doing all their testing. They feel that it was a high coumadin level, but because his legs were swollen, they can't chance that, and I'm sure they're going to check out the fact that it could be any kind of a blood clot before they release him. He said he was going to be in there for 2 or 3 days, and he was being fed vitamin K through intravenous, so he was all tagged up with tubes and really couldn't do anything. So we send him the best from all of us here at the EAL radio show, and we send a card to Jim to let him know that we're thinking about him, and hopefully he'll be on the road to mending and be back soon with us. I'll give him a call tomorrow and see how things are going, and then I can keep everyone in the loop.
Okay, well, let's see if we can get this airplane on the ground.
Steve, as usual. Be sure to tune in again next week, Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 364 will be taxiing from the gate with another great adventure. Mr. Producer, can you give us a clue about the next episode?
Well, we're going to take a trip back in the old days when people dressed up to get on airplanes, and the women had their hats and their white gloves, and the kids wore suits, even though our children, past riding, hated to put that suit on, a little tie, and dress up to be a past rider. But those were the days, and that's the way people traveled back in those days. The food was good. They were treated as if they were going across the Atlantic on the USS or the British ship, I can't even think of it. I think it was Elizabeth or the Queen Mary.
Queen Mary.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, Queen Mary.
The Queen Mary. And those were the good days, and we're going to talk about them on next week when we talk about how flying was back then. Chuck.
Well, that's our show for tonight, folks. And thanks to all our brats tonight. I thank all participating in tonight's broadcast, especially our listeners. With this, we take a line from the stories from Lake Wobegon, where all the Eastern women are unequal, all the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are way above average. Not brats at all now. Until then, we say, good night, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern. Hey. We love you.
Good night, night. Eastern.
Good show, Neil. Good show.
Very
good show.
Good. Very interesting, Neil.
Until we meet again. Adios. Au revoir. I'll be there.